Welcome to this evening's program. To those of you who do not know me, my name is Stanley Emerson. I am a member of the Adult Education Committee of B'nai Torah, which functions under the very able leadership of our chair, Sam Kapusta. Tonight's program, When Serious Illness Strikes and Decisions Have to Be Made, is being presented jointly by the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America, commonly known as the Orthodox Union, and by Torah in Motion. When I first heard of the program being presented, I thought that it was very interesting that one of the oldest Orthodox organizations in America, the OU, which was founded in 1898, is entering into a joint venture this evening with one of the newest and youngest of the Orthodox organizations, which was founded in Toronto just in 2001 by Rabbi Jay Kelman and by Rabbi Elliot Malamud. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the presence this evening of Larry Zeichman, who is here, the national president of OU of Canada. The Orthodox Union is known to many through its certification of kosher products. However, the OU is much more than that. As its name tells us, it is an organization of Orthodox synagogues throughout North America, and in fact has affiliations in Israel as well. And beyond that, the last 50 years or so has seen a tremendous increase and growth in the activities of the union. They're involved in many, a quick glance at their website will show you their multifarious activities. For instance, they're involved in educational, social welfare programs, advocacy. The Community Services Division, which is the division which is involved in tonight's program, and of which Frank Buchweitz, tonight's moderator, is the director, serves synagogues and particularly individuals through its highly popular programs on such matters as parenting, marriage, programs for singles, and in the past carried out task forces on substance and alcohol abuse among Orthodox young men and women. Torah in Motion, on the other hand, is the new kid on the block. But although managed part-time by only three people, Rabbi Jay Kelman, his wife Ilana, and Rabbi Elliot Malamut, has indeed a very impressive track record. Let me give you a few statistics. Torah in Motion is a pioneer of online interactive learning, and it is currently offering 11 online courses. There are over 800 registrants this semester from all over the world, including Poland, Israel, Australia, New York City, Los Angeles, Niagara Falls, and of course, Toronto. All classes are now video archived and available for viewing at one's convenience through their website. The MP3 library of past programs has almost 1,000 entries, and so far this year, there have been over 12,200 MP3 downloads of these programs. Over 2,900 people are on its electronic mailing list, and it has presented over 200 speakers since its inception in 2001. Torah in Motion has run programs in conjunction with established mainstream organizations, such as the OU tonight, Yeshiva University, Bar Ilan University, Matan, Mizrahi, Mekorot, Shari Tzedek Hospital of Jerusalem, Toronto's UJA Federation, as well as synagogues in the city. I believe that we are privileged to have such a dynamic organization as Torah in Motion in our city, and we are doubly privileged this evening to attend a program which was being presented by both the OU and Torah in Motion. Frank Buchweitz, Director of Community Services and Special Projects of the Orthodox Union, will be introducing tonight's panelists. Mr. Buchweitz is a recognized professional in the forefront of Jewish communal work and is a noted educator, administrator, innovator, and facilitator. As National Director of Community Services and Special Projects for the Orthodox Union, Frank is a unique event and program planning, has a unique event and program planning talent. As an educator, he has provided communities and synagogues with countless adult education programs. His positive Jewish parenting and marriage initiatives are legendary successes. He is supremely creative, a master at multitasking, and truly one of a kind. Frank Buchweitz has been in the fields of Jewish education and administration for the past 42 years. He is a licensed elementary school principal with a master's degree in educational administration and has also served in yeshivot and day schools and has influenced countless individuals and families through his wonderful work throughout the years. I now present Frank Buchweitz, who will introduce the evening and the speakers.
Thank you very much. What was not shared with you, I will share with you. My first position in 1967 was in Toronto. And the synagogue in which I prayed, the synagogue in which I davened, was this one, B'nai Torah. The rabbi at the time was Rabbi Shmuel Stauber. And I lived at 5 Fisherville, apartment 901.
It's still there.
Still there. Still there in spirit. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's really a pleasure coming home once again and being with you, being with Rabbi Kelman, and I thank you for the opportunity of our bringing, when illness strikes and decisions have to be made, to this community. Because we've brought this to communities throughout the country. And it's a program which I think you will find extremely beneficial. I received an email from a president of a synagogue, the Young Israel of Flatbush, and he said to me in the email, my father was nifta this past summer. This was a few years ago. Because of the program of when illness strikes, we were prepared. We knew what questions to ask. We knew who to consult and which halachic authority we should confer with. The decisions that had to be made were made in accordance with halacha, in accordance with Jewish law, and we were able to bring the doctor, the physician, and the family together so the social worker didn't decide the fate of our father. Unfortunately, he was nifta during the summer, but we thank the Orthodox Union for bringing this program to the community. I want to share with you very briefly two handouts which you should leave here with. And I brought this all the way from New York, 59 pounds in a suitcase. A booklet, When Serious Illness Strikes, it has articles. Read it at your leisure. A number of articles which I think will be extremely beneficial. And secondly, what's called an online registry. This past summer, we completed arrangements with the New York Legal Aid Group for registration of your health care directives. That means anywhere in the country, if it had to be accessed by medical personnel, the documentation can be accessed. So the question that I posed before coming here was, will this be valid in Toronto, in Canada? A good question. And the answer, New York Legal Aid Group said the answer is yes. Okay? Now, the directive is listed with the U.S. Living Will Registry. Do not send your form to them. First of all, it'll be $125. And secondly, it's the wrong address. It would go to the address that we have indicated here, and all of your directives, the halachic living will, which will be discussed by our rabbi, Rav Jakta. There are two types, one of RCA and one of Agudas Yisrael. The validity of it, you have to check in terms of Toronto, but in terms of the healthcare proxy, that can be registered. And all the information describing what it is, how it works, is all in this booklet. There are extras outside, extras being distributed. Ladies and gentlemen, our program works as follows. Very simple. We have five very, very special guests here. And each one has a certain expertise that they're going to share with you. We're going to hear from two physicians who are going to share with you cases, incidents that have occurred in the hospital, in the elder care home. And afterwards, that's going to be followed by our halakhic authority, because there are going to be a number of questions that will arise as to whether, according to Jewish law, these situations can be done. DNR, et cetera, et cetera. You'll hear about it. Then we're going to hear from our financial specialist, an elder care attorney, what protection you should have. And then finally, we're going to be hearing from our chaplain in terms of different care that is available. So ladies and gentlemen, this is a very special night. It's a very unique night. And we hope that you will leave here with so much education that you'll have to listen to the tape that Rabbi Kelman will have on his website to once again follow all the nuances and all of the information that are shared with you. So to begin with, we have Dr. Jonathan Abrams, who graduated from the University of Toronto Medical School. He has a master's in public health from Columbia University. He's a palliative care physician. Does everybody know what palliative care means? Raise your hands. Okay, very good. For those that don't, I'm sure there'll be a brief explanation. At Mount Sinai Hospital of Toronto, he has been a faculty member of the University of Toronto Medical School Family and Community Medicine Department since 2005. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Jonathan Abrams.
Good evening. That's my first slide, so I'm glad I'm first, because if I wasn't, I might run away. Let's just bring my presentation up here. Okay, you can advance to the first slide. You can go back. It's not that important, but there's a boxer in the ring with the referee, and he says, and in this corner, hey, where'd he go? Always introduce the smallest guy first. So that's me. So when illness strikes as the topic of the presentation, as I was introduced, I'm a physician. I do home-based palliative care through Mount Sinai's home-based service. We see people in their homes. I'm part of a team of doctors that follows patients with other agencies to support people with life-threatening illnesses in their homes. And not just people with lifelong chronic illnesses, but people with a limited prognosis, and our service defines that as people with less than a prognosis of 1 year. We follow people providing end-of-life supported care to them as well as to their families, and we deal mostly with cancer diagnoses, but we also deal with people of all ages, from pediatrics to geriatrics, young and old, facing a variety of terminal illnesses, whether it be heart end-stage heart disease or lung diseases that people may face. We also deal with children who may be born with congenital deformities or suffer other illnesses through their lives. Next slide. I decided to sort of present the main issues that I thought we should discuss this evening, and essentially it's, when is it enough? When do people decide and transition from more aggressive care to more supportive care? And one of the main issues would be the DNR, which is do not resuscitate order, that people are often posed with. And there's an alternative term that I've heard presented at a conference, and that is allow natural death. And I find that actually a much more palatable term. And when you think of it that way, I think the whole concept is a bit better. But what does it actually mean? And in a nutshell, it means no aggressive measures should be done, no CPR, which is chest compressions or intubation, placing someone on a respirator. And essentially, if you think about it, it does not address hydration, feeding, or antibiotics. People often think that if they sign a DNR, they've given up all treatments, and that's not true. DNR means if their heart stops, if they're unresponsive, no one's going to come and try and resuscitate them. And I think when you understand it from that point of view, it's a lot more acceptable. And yes, some people find that, oh, he's DNR. They think, I'll go into an emergency room, I'll be told, oh, he's DNR, they won't get proper care. But that's, I think, a fear people have, but good medicine shouldn't do that. Even if you're palliative, even if you're DNR, you still deserve and should get appropriate care if you're facing something that can be treated, and treated fairly easily. The other issues that I think we're going to talk about tonight are going to include nutrition, hydration issues, the issue around intravenous hydration, subcutaneous fluids, which means a small needle under the skin that doesn't go into a vein, and more aggressive things such as feeding tubes, whether they go through the nose or through the stomach, if someone can't eat, or more advanced than that would be IV nutrition, which is something called TPN, which is a technical term. We don't have to explain that, really, but it's total parenteral nutrition, which is something that would get set up in the hospital if someone wanted that. And I think the essential question that everyone needs to ask is, why are we doing? Why are you doing what you're doing, whether it's an aggressive treatment or more supportive care, and what your goals are from that? And I think what we have the benefit of in the panel tonight is bringing together both the medical and the halachic point of view in one place. I think in real life, these situations are highly variable. They're individual. There are many nuances. And there's no hard and fast rules. No one can come here tonight and tell you this is what everyone should do or shouldn't do. And awareness of the issues, I think, can really help foster a much greater understanding of the issues that everyone will face, whether themselves personally or through someone they love. The first case I wanted to present, and these are really aggregate cases. I couldn't bring forward to you actual cases. I felt for confidentiality that wouldn't be appropriate. So these are more aggregate cases of people I've dealt with. One would be a 95-year-old gentleman who has advanced dementia, has had it for the last 10 years. He has full-time private caregivers. He's fortunate enough to be able to afford that. And he's begun to not eat. He's at risk of choking. When they give him something to eat, he starts to aspirate, goes down the wrong tube, and they're having a harder time feeding him. He's starting to resist eating. He's bedbound. He's unable to care for himself at all, and he's dependent on others for his care. He has multiple medical issues, whether they be heart or lung issues, kidney problems. He's very frail, and his life expectancy, the doctors have said, are the order of weeks to months. What should be done? Should he receive supportive comfort care only, or should we be more aggressive? The family claims he never told them what he wanted to do if he stopped eating. And again, what should be done? Does he require a feeding tube, hydration? What about IV fluid? Should he get something to stop dehydration? Would it be different if he had previously expressed a wish to not be treated? And how explicit would that be? Many times people are not explicit, and what we as doctors present or ask families is, what would be the person's general gestalt of his life? What, you know, if someone else was sick, what did he say or she say? And how did he respond to those situations? To try and get a sense if the person never was able to verbalize it. Taking it a step further, what would happen if he was found unresponsive? Should 911 or now Hatsala be called? Should someone initiate CPR? Should they try and resuscitate him, restart his heart? So just some questions for thought. Next slide. The second case, and maybe we could say is even more difficult, it's a 58-year-old woman who's married, mother of four children, much younger, has advanced metastatic ovarian cancer. She's been battling the disease for 10 years, has had numerous ups and downs, but always come through. She's always pulled through. They've been able to offer her something, and she's made it, till now. She's just been told they can't offer any more chemotherapy or radiation, and her oncology team has no further cancer treatments available. She's at the end of the road. She's frail, she's weak, she's tired, but she still manages most of her own care. She has been referred to palliative care and is very scared. Should she agree to DNR? Should she be resuscitated? How should she answer that question? How does she transition from active treatments to more supportive care? Is she giving up, or is the focus of care simply shifting from primarily of treatment to more support? Or must she keep fighting, trying other treatments, and pursuing aggressive care? How does she choose, medically, halakhically, personally? I personally sense that people often live longer with supportive care. Monitoring symptoms and aggressive attention to issues can greatly improve a person's quality of life for both the patient and the family. Palliative care can and should be a continuum of care, even from diagnosis. Although our service is more limited and we provide care at the end of life, true palliative care is what I think every doctor does from the day they see a patient when they try and address their needs. Next slide. Talking about the issues may be very painful, but is often a relief for all involved and helpful in the long run and allows for better outcomes. Ignoring the issue is like the elephant in the room. And in many cases, I've heard people say, dealing about end-of-life issues is like going for surgery. It's very painful, but the outcome that's offered for both the living beyond and the person who's ill can be tremendous. And I often tell the patients, plan for the worst, but hope for the best. You can still hope for being comfortable, being supportive. And in a sense, it's like insurance. No one hopes they ever have to use their insurance, but it's in the drawer if they need it. The family knows what to do if the person gets sicker or if things don't go well. And I think by a person verbalizing and telling their loved ones what they want, it makes it tremendously easier for the family to make decisions, knowing that that's what Dad wanted, that's what Mom wanted later on down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Abrams. Our next speaker was not on the program initially, but he's joined the program, and you'll understand why when you hear him speak. Dr. Hyde Vash was graduated from medical school at McMaster University and completed his internal medicine and critical care medical fellowship at the University of Toronto. From 2002 to 2009, June 2009, he served as the clinical director of the intensive care unit at York Central Hospital. Dr. Dvash has a particular interest in end-of-life care issues in the ICU area especially, which includes conflict that arises in decision-making with respect to quite a number of issues, including organ and tissue donation. You're going to have quite a number of questions, I'm sure, that you would like to ask, and we'll have that opportunity at the conclusion of the program. In the middle of every table, you'll find some paper. We're going to take questions from the audience as well as taking written questions. So please take advantage of the opportunity as the thought develops. Write your question out, and we will collect it during the evening. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Dvash.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman and other rabbis. When you're in a room filled with people who are much more learned on issues of halakha and Torah, I see my Hebrew school principal at the back of the room. You embark on speaking with some trepidation. I'd like to take the time that was allowed to me and be a little bit interactive. I'm a physician. That's my background. I work in an intensive care unit. Out of curiosity, how many physicians are in the room, or are people who work in healthcare? So quite a few, most of the faces, many of the faces I recognize. How many lawyers in the room? Oh, there's a few brave people who raise their hands. Okay. how many people have had a loved one who's been critically ill in the intensive care unit? Okay, most hands. The intensive care unit is a pretty unusual and interesting and very rewarding place to work. I work at York Central Hospital just up the road. It's a very big and busy community hospital. We see 1,200 admissions a year. Unfortunately, about 200 of those patients will die in the intensive care unit, or about a 17-18% mortality rate. The good news is most people who come into intensive care unit leave the intensive care unit alive. But for those few that do not, I've often asked how well we've served those patients. In terms of the issues about do not resuscitate and code status and a lot of acronyms that get thrown about, no CPR, DNR, what's often missed is not so much the what's written on the chart, but what was the conversation that was had with the patient and with the family. And one of the things that we embarked on a few years ago is I had a volunteer graduate student do a chart review of those patients who died in the intensive care unit at our hospital and looked at 100 consecutive deaths. And what we found was a quarter of those patients who were admitted to the intensive care unit actually had a do not resuscitate order or some limitation in their care prior to actually coming into the ICU. So just because you have a do not resuscitate order on your chart doesn't mean that you won't be admitted to the intensive care unit. That being said, 75% of the patients who died in the intensive care unit did not have that order on the chart. And we actually looked at what the code status or the level of care at time of death, we found that 87% of patients, 87 of the 100 patients who died in the ICU had some degree of a limitation in their care, i.e. a no CPR order was written on the chart. So what often happens is in the vast majority of cases of patients who die in the ICU is a transition of care from aggressive care to one of where there's limitation in care and comfort care. And that's a reality of every ICU in the world. And the struggle that we have is at what point does the burden of suffering from the interventions and the life support machines and drugs that we have available become too great for a person to bear at the expense of comfort. And that's not an easy decision. It's not an easy decision for patients, certainly not for families, and also it's not an easy decision for physicians. And so the approach that we try to take is one of collaborative decision making. Rarely situations of conflict do arise. It's not surprising when you think about the high-charged environment, the emotions at play, the fact that you know the best time to fix the roof is when it's sunny, not when it's a downpour. And so addressing these issues in advance amongst families when patients are well, early in a diagnosis as opposed to at the crisis is always preferred but rarely achieved. And so in situations where conflict does arise, one of the pitfalls is that if you go down the path of an adversarial approach, I'm the doctor and I say this, and I'm the patient and I'm the family and we say that, is you get an entrenchment of and polarization of views. Again, it's difficult to use individual cases. I think of one in particular that was in the public record, and that is the Golubchuk case out of Manitoba, which I'm sure many people were familiar of from not this past summer, but the summer before. Of an 84-year-old gentleman at the St. Boniface Hospital in Winnipeg in their ICU. And, you know, some of the vitriolic comments from that were reported in the Winnipeg Free Press are quite shocking. And at the same time, if you look at the Canadian Jewish News and some of the things that the family's lawyer was quoted as saying is also can be a bit shocking. And I actually know the physician who cared for Mr. Golubchuk, who's the IC director at the St. Boniface, and he's actually a bioethicist. He's actually not a bad guy. He's an okay guy. And I'm sure that the Golubchuk family was also equally loving, caring family. And if you lose sight of that, it's very easy to get in this adversarial trap. And by the time the wheels fall off the cart and people end up in the courts, it's really a failure of the system. It's a failure of the family to recognize that there are avenues of conversation. And I think it's a duty for physicians to make sure that families are aware of chaplaincy support, social work support, bioethics support, rabbinic support, and so forth. I wrote a letter to the editor to the Canadian Jewish News after Mr. Golubchuk passed, and basically what I said in it was, you know, these are issues that are dealt with every day, and if you take a confrontational approach, it's going to create a broigus. It's going to create a lot of grief for many, many people. What I try to do, and what I, you know, even a case just last month, I had a lady in the intensive care unit who was doing quite poorly, had end-stage lung disease, was on a ventilator. It gets to the point where the ventilator is actually causing harm to the lungs by inflating under such high pressures that the lungs were continuing to deteriorate in spite of all the interventions. And the patient was, by all accounts, suffering quite deeply. The family was Jewish. They consulted their rabbi who came in. They weren't actually very religious. They had the Chabad rabbi come in. And like any expert physician, for a rabbi to give a halachic opinion, any expert opinion, you have to be made aware of the facts. So I make sure that the rabbi actually comes into the hospital, meets with me, sees the patient, sits down with me together with the family, assuming we have the family's permission, and I can outline the details of the case and the course in hospital so that any halachic opinion is truly an informed opinion. In that particular situation, there was a decision of no escalation of care, that if her heart were to stop, we would not try to resuscitate the heart. We would continue with her current interventions, but if new interventions, if new problems arose, that we would not escalate care and treat new problems as they arise, which typically in the ICU they inevitably do. And the patient did die several days later. That would, and you know, the rabbi was satisfied, the family was relieved that they had done things in accordance with their traditions and felt supported by the medical team and their rabbi, and I think they did their mother good. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Dr. Vash. Ladies and gentlemen, our third speaker of the evening is Rabbi Howard Jachter, who serves as the Dayan of the Beis Din of Elizabeth, New Jersey, and he has acquired an international reputation of excellence in the area of get administration. He teaches at Torah Academy of Bergen County and has authored two highly acclaimed volumes of Gray Matter, which discusses contemporary halachic issues of major importance. A third volume is expected to be published this coming year. He has authored dozens of scholarly articles that have appeared in prestigious Torah, both in Israel and in the United States. His weekly columns on halacha and Tanakh, available on the website www.koltorah.org, are read by thousands worldwide. He is a member of the Rabbinical Council of America's Halachic Committee, and he is the chairman of its Igun Resolution Committee, Rabbi Howard Jachter.
Thank you very much to come here in Toronto and speak to you. It's a great honor. I'll begin by sharing with you a case history, a very intensely personal case history, and that was how I, together with my sister, managed my mother's illness that led ultimately to her death. And it's very, very instructive, and we're going to see five lessons that emerge from this very sad case. My mother told me more than once, and she told my sister, who were her only children, and her close family and friends, don't let me suffer. Don't let me lie and suffer. She wrote out a health care proxy. She named me and designated me as the one who would make the health care decisions for her in case of incapacity. In April of 1995, sadly, my mother suffered a very, very serious stroke. We institute made sure that there was aggressive treatment that was administered, but unfortunately she remained unconscious. When already in September of 1995, doctor recommended that we put a DNI order, do not resuscitate, do not intubate order, for my mother. I sought a second opinion before I made that awesome decision whether to sign the DNR and DNI order. After I received the second opinion from that rabbi saying that they agreed that it was appropriate, I then at that point did not rely upon my own judgment, but rather I asked my Rebbe, my teacher, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, asked him in this circumstance, my mother was unconscious for so many months, if in such a circumstance was permissible to put my mother to sign a DNI order for my mother. And his decision was as follows. He permitted the DNR and the DNI order. However, we want to clarify that he also required that nutrition and oxygen continue to be administered. My mother was fed through a feeding tube. Halacha thoroughly rejects active euthanasia and even passive euthanasia. What halacha does allow is eliminating or avoiding an impediment to death. In August of 1997, nearly 2 years later, I received a sad call from the nursing home saying that my mother's life was in danger and the only way she could be saved was for her to be intubated. I reminded them of the DNI and that, however, that oxygen should be administered. She should have that comfort. Unfortunately, she passed away a day later. Now, there are five lessons that we can learn from this. Very, very critical lessons. And I would even a little boldly suggest that the name for tonight's session should not be When Illness Strikes, but rather should be Before Illness Strikes. Because my mother was so wise, and I must say, as time goes along, looking back, my mother becomes wiser every year as time goes along, that she took the wise step. Apparently, Dr. Dvasha experienced this as rare, but she was wise. She thought about this. She addressed this long before her illness. She took the steps to explain to her family in very simple, easy-to-remember terms, don't let me lie and suffer. She made sure there was a health care proxy. So this way, there's not an argument among family members who's going to be making the decision. Now, I urge that all of you take a look at the new health care proxy that the Rabbinical Council of America, together with the Orthodox Union, has just issued. Just came out this past summer, August 2009. And there what they allow you to do is to name a proxy. Of course, it allows for an alternate. And a rabbi that the proxy should consult, and an alternate as well. And that's also very important, as we'll discuss. It also urges that a discussion should be held with the rabbi, the proxy, and family members, so that eventually the family can live with the decision. I, my sister, were and are at peace with this decision because we know it was my mother's will. She made it clear. We asked an outside source, and I didn't make the decision. And I would suggest that in addition to having the healthcare proxy, that you should write an informal and simple non-binding letter to family members, to the rabbi, to friends, just explaining one's wishes in very general terms. I was told that living wills can potentially, if they're not formulated properly, we'll hear more from our legal expert shortly, that actually can hinder care. That in certain cases, that there can be limitations placed on what doctors can do because a living will. My advice is healthcare proxy and informally address with the proxy. But I would add to the RCA document and say OU document that it's not enough simply to express it orally, but after all, the proxy, you can conduct the conversation with the proxy, and a situation can come up years later. A rabbi can have many, many people who have nominated him as the person who should be consulted by the proxy. Is he going to remember all the nuances of the conversation? The rabbi should take notes, but you should also make sure the rabbi has just an informal letter sent to him, non-binding, make it clear what a person's wishes are. Now, the mainstream, what Rabbi Willig's ruling that he gave to me, in my perception, I want to stress in my perception, because different rabbis perceive things differently, what is the mainstream opinion? In my opinion, from my vantage point, Rabbi Willig's ruling represented mainstream opinion that allowed in such extreme circumstances where a person is clearly, permanently, and irreversibly unconscious in a permanent vegetative state, would allow a DNR and DNI. However, there are some Rabbanim who would urge fighting for the last breath. There are, on the other hand, a small minority of rabbis who permit not only a DNR, DNI, but even withholding food and oxygen. So can you imagine if you don't have the healthcare proxy signed, and if you don't have a healthcare proxy that also names the rabbi who should be consulted? Can you imagine the scene that can happen with a family arguing over which rabbi should be consulted? Yes, they'll say there's the healthcare proxy. He's supposed to make the decision. Well, who should he consult? Which rabbi should be consulted? And there, and I want to stress, there, and you can take a look in the article that has been photocopied for this evening that I wrote. It's in the last chapter of my latest volume of Gray Matter. There's a wide range of opinions. The last thing that you want to have is an argument in the ICU amongst family members what should be done. That can leave lasting scars. Because this is such an emotionally charged issue, this can leave lasting family rifts that can be permanent and will never heal because of the intensity and gravity of such a major issue. That's why it's very, very important to name the proxy, but also name the person name the rabbi that a person that you want consulted. Because at that point, there's no argument. Because the decision has been made, this is what the patient wants, and there's no arguing. It's very important to seek a second medical opinion. I find it amazing that some people will spend more time consulting more people and more opinions deciding on which car to buy than they will about major medical decisions. Fourth lesson to learn is that I continued throughout the more than 2 years. I visited my mother. I lived about 30 miles away, once or twice a week. I called the nurses twice daily. I monitor care to make sure that the DNR order does not degenerate to DNT, do not treat. It's not what should happen. It's not as we heard before. It's not what, it's not good medicine. But a lot of times you have to be vigilant. This is what I've been told by a wide variety of people. You have to be their advocate. If the patient is unconscious or is weakened and is not able to be their own spokesman, is not able to represent themselves, you have to show care. If you show concern, then their care will be done properly. And lastly, the lesson to learn is that one should consult an outside opinion and for a decision. I didn't make that decision. I was well aware of all the halachic issues. I left it for Rabbi Willig because family members have their own biases, have their own issues, And it's hard to make an objective decision because, after all, you're schlepping in all the time. We all have very, very busy lives. And your lives are set topsy-turvy when there's a loved one who is in the ICU, who is in who's in a nursing home. And if you've experienced this, you know what I'm talking about. There's a lot of pressure. There can be financial pressure as well. And therefore, it's for your own well-being, so you can feel at peace with yourself down the road, and so that other family members should be able to be at peace with the decision that's being made. So it's so important to consult a rabbi, consult an outside opinion. I want to make six observations, and hopefully I don't ruffle any feathers with them. First of all, I want to make it clear, from my vantage point, mainstream Orthodox opinion is that removal from life support, if it will kill the patient directly, is forbidden under all circumstances. Right? Number two, a patient who is in a permanent vegetative state is considered to be alive. There is no halachic, no Orthodox halachic authority that will say that a patient whose the brain is still may not be able to engage in cognition, not the thought process. But nonetheless, if it's still maintaining the command and control center, it's maintaining respiration and other functions of the body, that person is still considered to be alive according to all halachic opinions. And number three, and here's where I really hope this is the most controversial thing I believe that I'm going to say this evening, in my reading, that the overwhelming majority of the halachic authorities do not regard brain death as death. So, for example, if you go to, from a halachic perspective, almost all the major halachic authorities at Yeshiva University do not recognize brain death as death. There are those Orthodox rabbis, especially many in the religious Zionist community in Israel, who disagree. But nonetheless, that's what I understand to be the mainstream halachic opinion. The Rabbinical Council of America Halachic Committee will be issuing a paper on this. I wrote in my book, which was published about a year ago, that it's soon to be released, and it's still soon to be released, and we'll see when it's going to be released, studying the issue already now for more than 3 years. Three more observations, and then I'm going to address the cases that Dr. Abrams mentioned. Morphine. Morphine should not be a backhanded means of euthanasia. That does not mean that the halacha forbids administering morphine. Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, one of the great halachic authorities, specifically permits administration of morphine. He argues that, first of all, the pain that it's coming to relieve also is a threat to the patient and also to an illness, and it can be treated. And a doctor, in many circumstances, is permitted to assume risk in trying to heal the patient. So in trying to eliminate pain, morphine is allowed. However, it all depends on two major points. And these issues are very delicate. Halachic authority, your rabbi, must be consulted with these issues. Intentions is so important. If it's a backhanded means of euthanasia, it's forbidden. If it has to be also administered in gradually. Number five, it's very important not to blur the roles of rabbis and doctors. Rabbis are not doctors, and doctors are not rabbis. Even if the rabbi is a doctor, if he is not a practicing physician, he is still not capable of making the decision. Even if the doctor has smicha, if he is not a practicing rabbi, he is not able to make the halakhic decision. There needs to be, as Dr. Dvash mentioned, there must be a collaborative effort. And it's really most appropriate there should be a sit-down together so that the family, the doctor, the rabbi can sit down together. And I agree wholeheartedly with Dr. Dvash said that the rabbi should come. This is not something to be for the rabbi to make the decision from, if at all possible, just from the phone. Hava Nerda, right? To come down and look. It ain't odoma shmiel l'ria, the Gemara tells you. You may get such a different impression when you actually come down and see the patient. So that's very, very important. And six, I want to stress that the halakha permits the DNR only in very limited circumstances, only when a patient is near death, and only when a person is clearly permanently unconscious. Now, to address the two cases, I'm going to quote from one of the great halakha authorities of the 20th century, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and here's a quote, and these terms are going to be very difficult to define, but very important quote. We are not obligated to administer non-routine and painful treatments which serve only to lengthen life and do not cure the fundamental problem. Now, how do you define that? What's a non-routine treatment? And what is a treatment that only serves to lengthen life and not to cure a fundamental problem is not a simple issue. And that's where the coordination, the important coordination between the rabbis and the doctors is so, so important. Let's address the two cases. What's the fundamental difference between the two cases? The fundamental difference between the two cases are as follows. In the first case that Dr. Abrahams mentioned, the patient is not able to make the decision for themselves. So if they appointed a healthcare proxy and if they expressed their decision, that decision should be respected. However, if they did not tell the proxy what to do, says Rav Moshe Feinstein, you should follow what most people would choose in such a situation. In the situation described, it would seem to be clear, a 95-year-old person who is for suffering advanced state of dementia, it seems most intelligent, again, for the mainstream opinion within the halakha. Not everybody agrees. The mainstream opinion of Moshe Feinstein, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, would agree, in my opinion, in these cases, that there can be a DNR or DNI order. However, Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman, again, not everybody agrees, but Rav Moshe, Shlomo Zalman, Omer Brobach would say, in this case, he has to be fed. He must be fed. I'm going to say no matter what, but with an exception. But that, again, requires the coordination between the rabbi and the doctor, because if the rabbi is going to say he has to be fed no matter what, well, that may be medically contraindicated. So therefore, you need a collaborative team effort to try to figure out what is in the best interest of the patient. And if you're going to say, well, halacha, again, is against passive euthanasia, it only condones removing impediment to death. Food, nutrition, is hydration, oxygen, those are not impediments to death. That's why most halacha authorities do not allow that to be removed unless the food itself actually can actually reduce the amount of time, can endanger the patient and reduce their life expectancy. Case number two. That's a little bit more complex. You're dealing with an individual who can make a decision. So first of all, in that decision, I would emphasize the first thing that should be done is to seek a second opinion. Yes, the team says that all options have been exhausted, but maybe let's ask another doctor, ask another specialist, get from another perspective. So many times, one team are used to looking at things one way, of a certain style. Maybe there are different styles, different interventions. It's worth, if at all possible, to seek a second opinion. And sometimes my experience has been that there's been pressure from medical staff not to seek a second opinion. However, everyone should leave there, should check their ego at the door, and everyone should be looking out for the best interest of the patient and to seek a second opinion. Now, argues Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in this case. This case, the individual can make the decision. Well, what do you encourage this person? Let's say the team says that there's no hope. The second opinion says there's no hope. It's time now for palliative care. Well, should at this point, should we be looking to fight for the last breath, are we looking for to maximize comfort, or are we trying to maximize our quality of life, so to speak, or are we trying to maximize length of life? Well, there's a nuanced machloket, disagreement amongst the halachic opinions. Even though Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, we just quoted before, that you're not obligated, I'll say it again, you're not obligated to administer non-routine and painful treatments, which serve only to lengthen life and do not cure the fundamental problem. Still, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, you should, and this is a general rule, and there can be exceptions, and here's where the skill of the rabbi to tailor the halacha to the needs of this specific patient. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes as a general rule, the patient in such a circumstance should be encouraged to fight to maximize life, even though that means that they will suffer more. Why? Because of the great opportunities that life in this world presents. As the Mishnah states in Pirkei Avot, Yafesh Sha'achat Bo'olam Hazeh Mikol Chayei Olam Haba, Greater is even 1 hour in this world than all of the world to come. In this world we can do mitzvahs. In this world we can do kindness. There's so many things that we can do in a certain way is even greater than the next world. Also, you could say this is the mother of four and 58 years old. Perhaps she wants to set an example. It's important for her to set an example for the children of Tzipis Elishua. It's so important. We're asked that the Gemara says in Shabbos after 120 years. Did you look to always try to find Yeshua? Did you always have hope? We should have hope. We're the only one, there's only one nation in the world whose national anthem is Hatikvah, and that's a Jewish state, and that is Medinat Yisrael. Hatikvah, so maybe that's the way Rav Shlomo Zalman will say that should be encouraged. Rav Moshe Feinstein does not write that should be necessarily encouraged. That's something that, if you're a rabbi, a nuance, a sub-machloket between Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Moshe Feinstein. Even though it's permitted, you still try to encourage the patient to nonetheless fight for every last moment. And finally, at the end of the day, the woman should be given the choice of giving that opportunity. Does she want to pursue aggressive care, or does she want to maximize her comfort? Just want to conclude with the following thought, and I want to share with you just from my experience of dealing with my mother. Yes, it was hard. It was hard going for all the time to week after week and see my mother suffering. It was very, very painful. But what kept me going is as follows. I always remembered that kibud av va'em, it makes it to the aseret hadibros, honoring your parents. What's honoring your parents? Eat your peas, eat your vegetables. That's not honoring your parents. What honoring your parents is, says the Gemara, is ma'achilo mashkeu. You feed them, you help them, you give them the drink, you help them get in, get out into the house, out of the house. Caring for parents, kibud av va'em comes at its greatest moments. Its greatest intensity is At when the parents are in most in need, at the most vulnerable and weakest moments of their lives. It always kept me going, that this is a big test, this is an Nisayon that Hashem has given to me at this point of my life. This is the time to honor that commandment, that mitzvah, which makes it to our top 10 list, the Aseret Dibrot of Kibud av va'em. Thank you very much.
I think that Rabbi Jachter underscored the importance of people being able to talk to each other and the preparation that's so important that should take place. We have to get the Rav, Aseh Lecha Rav, which it says in Pirkei Avos. We have to find a Rav. We have to find our Rav, who is our halachic authority, to speak to the doctors, to be able to also speak to the family and bring the family together. Now, Rabbi Jachter mentioned that you should name a proxy, you should name a Rav. But ladies and gentlemen, make sure that they accept your naming them. It's very important, because you could select a doctor, you could select a Rav, but if the Rav doesn't know about it or doesn't agree to it or moves 300 miles away, he's not going to do you much good. So what happens when you register your document through the OU registry with NILAG? Every year, you will receive information to update the proxy that you have, if there are any changes, if you have a different Rav, if you have anyone that should be listed or not listed, any changes whatsoever, they're in touch with you. The registration agreement gives the registry permission to send a copy of your healthcare proxy to any healthcare provider, whether it be a hospital, a doctor, a skilled nursing facility, a home health care agency, providers of home health care, ambulatory surgery centers, hospices. Once you are registered, and it's free of charge for those that came in late, you're registered for life. The registry will not release any information to any party other than a health care provider, so that your personal information is kept completely private, kept completely confidential, just like a medical record. The document is electronically stored in the registry's computer along with the registrant's emergency contact information. Be prepared. and one of the areas that require tremendous, tremendous preparation, where individuals can find that they can be broke very easily, and healthcare doesn't discriminate, health, illness doesn't discriminate whether you're young or old. Take a look at the swine flu epidemic that we have now. Young people are being very affected. Older people are also. An accident can take place, and that person, no matter what age, can have a lot of sorrows on his hands. Ladies and gentlemen, our next speaker, an elder care attorney. Rachel Blumenfeld is a partner in the prestigious Toronto law firm Miller Thompson. Have any cards? We have cards. I'm kidding. However, if anyone wants to speak with her, I'm sure she'll be happy to help you. Her practice focuses in the areas of trusts, estates, tax law and charities, and not-for-profit law. She has delivered workshops to insurance and financial advisors, fundraising professionals, and fellow lawyers on topics involving retirement and estate planning, life-insured buy-sell agreements, business succession planning, and planned giving. Doing these programs around the country, what I usually ask for at this time before introducing the attorney, the elder care attorney, is just for a show of hands. How many people have wills? Please raise your hand. This is a good group. Toronto is great. It's not always the hands being up in many communities. To my surprise, there are so many people that do not have wills. Especially those that are younger, because it'll never happen to them. They don't need it. They're so wrong. Ladies and gentlemen, Rachel Blumenfeld.
And I guess I didn't need to bring so many cards since everybody raised their, practically everyone raised their hands that they do have wills. That is good to see because, as you said, I find it is rare to have such a large group with so many people's hands going up in terms of having gone through the process of preparing wills and powers of attorney. What I'm going to sort of try to do tonight is bring the legal and in particular the perspective of what happens in Ontario. Thank you. Yes. Maybe I really should have gone first. What happens in Ontario in terms of who can make decisions for someone who is critically ill when that person is unable to make the decisions. So when would what we call a substitute decision maker step in? How is that person appointed, and what would they be responsible for doing? I'm going to talk both about powers of attorney and decision makers in terms of property and dealing with assets when somebody becomes incapable, as well as I'll spend more time given the topics this evening on. Substitute decision making regarding personal care and health care. Sure. So those of you who have wills in place, do you also all have powers of attorney? Yes? Good. Okay. So this may be familiar to you. In Ontario, there are generally two types of powers of attorney that someone will prepare. One is referred to as a continuing power of attorney for property, and the other is the power of attorney for personal care. Under the continuing power of attorney for property, you would be appointing someone to step into your shoes, to deal with your assets, to deal with your property, to make decisions regarding assets and property, financial decisions for you. The reason it's called a continuing power of attorney is because it continues once somebody becomes incapable. The power of attorney for personal care, there, and I'll talk about, I guess you would have picked up, this booklet, I think, or it's on the tables. And this is what Rabbi Jachter was talking about, the proxy and the directive regarding healthcare decisions. And I'll talk about that when we talk about powers of attorney for personal care in Ontario and how you can incorporate these types of what we call, or what we refer to very often as a living will or a healthcare directive, into a power of attorney that's done in Ontario. Taking over a little bit there. So just briefly, when would a power of attorney for personal care and a power of attorney for property come into effect? The power of attorney for property generally will come into effect when it's executed, even though the intention is that it's generally that it would only be used when the person who made the power of attorney, when the grantor becomes incapable of managing their own property. We put some safeguards around that because usually your intention is only that it's used on incapacity. So that what happens very often in Ontario is that the lawyers will hold on to the original power of attorney for property and only release it on the incapacity of the person. Power of attorney for personal care is only used if that person, if the grantor, is incapable of making decisions about their personal care, about their health care. Incapacity, depending on the situation, is a sliding scale. And we have some guidance from the legislation, the Substitute Decisions Act, which is the legislation that deals with powers of attorney. And there are under this legislation, there are a number of tests of capacity and incapacity. And there are a number of instances when you would be looking to these tests. One would be making the power of attorney for property or the power of attorney for personal care. So the legislation, again, sets out tests for whether the person is capable of actually giving instructions and making that power of attorney. As well, the legislation deals with situations of when the person would be considered capable or incapable of managing property or capable or incapable of making personal care decisions. So these tests are very important to determine when that power of attorney can be used, when the person when the person who's appointed under the power of attorney should be relying on it and making decisions on behalf of the incapable person. I've had quite a few situations where someone will come to me. Generally, it's an older person, and in particular where there's a situation where there's a dispute or a potential dispute between the children or among the children of that person. And what the instructions to me are potentially something that's going to cause a rift between the children or between a spouse and children from a prior marriage. In those situations, what I will very often do, especially if the person is elderly or is ill, I will bring in what's called a capacity assessor. So somebody who's registered to do assessments of capacity, whether it's capacity to make the power of attorney or capacity to actually manage property or to make decisions. I will bring somebody in who generally is a healthcare provider, whether it's a doctor, sometimes a social worker, psychologist, psychiatrist, to actually assess the person and to provide a report that I would have in my files that I can rely on if down the road there's a dispute over whether the person was actually capable at the time that they made that power of attorney. Do the same things with wills, but that's a topic for another evening. A lot of times when I'm dealing with clients putting together power of attorney and having them execute powers of attorney, one of the big issues and one of the big questions that they have is, well, who should I appoint? Who should be step into my shoes to make decisions for me, to manage my property, and to make healthcare decisions? In certain situations, and actually very often on under the power of attorney for property, you would be appointing the same people or the same, perhaps it's the same institution if you're appointing a corporation, a trust company. So it would be very often be the same as who you've appointed under your will. Some of the issues that come up are whether children should be appointed, whether all of your children should be appointed under the power of attorney, only one of them, the eldest, the youngest. Each situation is different, and each situation can develop into issues. My preference and my when I'm working with clients where there may be these types of issues, I try to encourage them to sit down with their kids, to bring their children in, so that we can have a discussion about who it is going to be who makes those decisions and who they've appointed. With respect to personal care, the person that you've appointed under your power of attorney for personal care does not necessarily have to be the same person as under the power of attorney for property. And very often, you're looking at for somebody with very different skills and very different a different relationship, perhaps, with yourself when you're making these documents. So doesn't necessarily have to be the same thing. However, they should be able to get along with the person that you've appointed under your power of attorney for property, because they're going to have to work together. There may have to be decisions regarding the assets and property and financial decisions that are made that will directly affect the care that the person is going to be able to receive. Just very briefly, in terms of acting under a power of attorney for property, again, the person is going to be managing assets. Now, in some cases, the power of attorney for property will come into play, will be relied on when the person is still capable. So even in a situation where you go away, you're going to Florida for 4 months, you need somebody here to be able to do your banking, to pay your bills, to sell your house, whatever it is. When the grantor, when the person is capable and somebody is acting under the power of attorney, that person who's acting is acting as their agent, and they're required to act only on the instructions of the attorney for property, on the instructions of the grantor. When the person is incapable, if the grantor becomes incapable and you're acting under a power of attorney for property, the relationship shifts and the responsibilities of that person shift, and the attorney for property is considered a fiduciary. And they are required to act only in the best interest of the incapable person. So you can't, when you're acting under a power of attorney, you can't be doing something that's going to benefit yourself. You can only act for the benefit of that person. Occasionally there'll be limits on the power in the power of attorney for property. So the person will limit what the attorney can do to, say, a real estate deal or dealing with certain banks, that kind of thing. They may want to include instructions in the power of attorney regarding giving charitable gifts, giving gifts or support to other family members. They may want to allow for certain tax transactions to occur. What happens if there's no power of attorney? Well, in the case of a power of attorney for property, first of all, it may be a situation where all of that person's assets are held jointly with the spouse. And in those cases, usually there isn't an issue. The spouse was able to step in and manage the assets for the incapable spouse. However, that's not always the case, especially if one spouse is predeceased. And there is a mechanism under the legislation, under the Substitute Decisions Act, where the public guardian and trustee of Ontario would step in and become what's called the statutory guardian of the person. And essentially, as soon as somebody is deemed to be incapable, if there is no one else out there to manage their assets, the PGT, public guardian may step in and take over management of that person's assets. That's usually not something that you want to have happen. So you want to, again, ensure that there's a power of attorney that can be relied on in the case of an incapacity. It is fairly straightforward to be able to replace the PGT as the guardian for property. It's usually what we call an over-the-counter application, where somebody in the family wants to step in and become the guardian of property. They would work with the PGT's office, come up with what's called a management plan, and obtain an over-the-counter order to become the guardian of property. In some cases, where it's a contentious matter, where not all of the all the family members are on the same side, and you've got siblings or children groups of children who wish to become the guardian, there may have to be a court application. This can be a pretty expensive and unpleasant type of situation to be in. So moving now to powers of attorney for personal care. Again, this is where you're appointing someone to make personal care decisions that are a whole range of decisions, not only end-of-life type of decisions. Things regarding whether the person should be admitted to a nursing home or receive care at home, setting up all those kinds of things. Even things from whether the person should be getting Meals on Wheels. There's a whole range of decisions that would fall under or that would be something that the attorney for personal care would be responsible for. It's very important in these situations, and I think this has come up all three of our previous speakers, it's very important for the grantor, for the person making the power of attorney, to set out what their wishes are. The legislation specifically says that when somebody is acting under a power of attorney or under a guardianship order for a guardianship of the person, their first duty is to make decisions that that person would have wanted. So essentially what you're doing is you're stepping into the shoes of the incapable person and making personal care decisions that they would have wanted. So it's very important to set out what those wishes are. Where those wishes or have not been set out, the legislation then says, well, first of all, the next step would be to make decisions that are in the best interest of that person. And it's interesting that in the legislation, in both the Substitute Decisions Act and in what's called the Healthcare Consent Act, the first line of what is in the best interest of that person is, well, what are their values? You want to look at what their values and grab the wording here. The values and beliefs that the person knows that the incapable person held when capable and believes he or she would still act on if capable. So, you know, I think that came out clearly this evening, that it's really critical that when you're putting together powers of attorney, whether it's and healthcare directives, that the person that you're appointing understand what your beliefs are, what your values are, and what sort of decisions you would want to have made. The document that you had, the online registry that was distributed, has at the back of it the proxy and directive with respect to healthcare decisions. This is an American document. What my suggestion would be when you're preparing powers of attorney and you want to include instructions to your attorneys, to your substitute decision maker, that they are to look to halakha, that they're to look to Jewish law and make decisions in accordance with Jewish law, that you incorporate provisions similar to the ones that are here right into the power of attorney for personal care. And in fact, I recognize some of these provisions. These are things that I have used in powers of attorney for personal care where I've dealt with Orthodox clients. So you can certainly, in the power of attorney for personal care, put in instructions that deal with decisions being made in accordance with Jewish law. You can name a rabbi or a religious authority that you instruct your attorney to turn to help them make those decisions. Other types of instructions that we sometimes will see in a power of attorney for personal care deal with very often a person will want to include instructions that they're to stay in their own home, or the opposite, that they're to go into a nursing home. Those are the types of instructions that you can put directly into your power of attorney for personal care. It's in this latter one, it's very important then to have a corresponding provision in your power of attorney for property that instructs that person, the attorney for property, to pay for all of this care, whether it's staying in your own home or whether it's going into a certain type of nursing care. Again, I just want to touch on a couple of situations where there isn't a power of attorney for property, a power of attorney for personal care. In those situations, you would look to what's called the Healthcare Consent Act, and under that legislation, there's sort of a hierarchy of who the medical profession, who the healthcare professionals would turn to, where decisions need to be made regarding consent to treatment, regarding emergency treatment, and regarding admission to a care facility. The first line would be the guardian of the person. So that's if there's been an order made that a guardian has been appointed, a guardian of the person is appointed. Second would be the attorney for personal care. But again, if there isn't a guardian, if there isn't an attorney for personal care, there's a number of other sort of another hierarchy that one can look to. The third, as you'll see on this list, the third person would be somebody that's appointed by the board, which is the Consent and Capacity Board under the Healthcare Consent Act. And what happens in those situations is if there isn't somebody who's there to make a decision, very specific decision about whether it's about treatment or about admission to a care facility, there's an ability to convene a tribunal or a board of generally a lawyer, a doctor, somebody from the hospital who would make the decision as to who can make the decision. They don't make the care decision or the treatment decision for that person. What they're doing is appointing or determining who it is that can make the decision for the person. Then we get into spouse or partner, child or parent of the incapable person, parent who has access to right of access to the incapable person, and then lastly, siblings and other relatives. So that's sort of the hierarchy of who gets to make decisions. Again, like with a guardianship order for property, there's also an ability to have somebody appointed as the guardian of the person. There isn't the same sort of over-the-counter procedure as you have with a power of attorney for property. There would need to be a court order, hopefully not a contentious proceeding, but if there, you know, it could be a situation where siblings or children disagree and each come to the court to be appointed, and the court would have to determine who it is becomes the guardian of the person. Generally, it would not be someone who's the healthcare provider, unless that person, of course, is a spouse or a child. And in these situations, the public guardian is very loath to get involved, the public guardian and trustee's office. They will only in very, very limited circumstances step in and become the temporary guardian of the person to make personal care decisions. With that, we'll turn it over
our last speaker, and then we open the floor for questioning. And we ask Susan to please go around and collect any additional questions. I have a few already. Our last speaker is Rabbi Ronald Weiss, who served as pulpit rabbi for 12 years before moving to Toronto in July 1994, where he serves currently as the Director of Chaplaincy Services at Jewish Family and Child Services. Rabbi Weiss represents the Jewish community on the Ontario Multi-Faith Council for Spiritual and Religious Care. He is the only rabbi in Toronto to carry a badge. He serves as the Jewish chaplain for the Toronto Police Service, as well as he being an advisor to the York Region Police Service and works with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Rabbi Weiss, again, is the chaplain of the Jewish Hospice Program and provides spiritual care and counseling to terminally ill patients in the Jewish community. Rabbi Ronald Weiss.
Does this come out? Okay. That's fine. Thank you very much. With all due respect, Rachel, I think if the smallest goes first, I should have. I win.
Yeah, no, I'm mindful of the itch. Thank you very much. When it comes to chaplaincy and spiritual support in times of crisis, pastoral care is often overlooked by families because they don't understand the central impact that spiritual support can provide when individuals are in trauma, when a crisis strikes. With respect to doctors are great. Doctors do wonderful things. Doctors are stretched to the maximum. Nurses are great. They do wonderful things. They have too much to do. Rabbis, as a former pulpit rabbi, I know how busy they are. Poskim, I'm not a posek. When I have a family who's in crisis, I always encourage them to go to their rav, go to their posek, and get hadracha, get guidance and direction from someone upon whose wisdom they rely upon. What do I do? I'm the fellow who wrestles with trauma. Could I have the next slide, please? Okay, just keep clicking. Keep going faster. Okay. All right, so this was the title of tonight's talk. Next slide, please. The spiritual religious challenges, those are the ones that I would try to underline. Please, next. Chaplaincy works to bridge the class of culture between religious values and medical perspectives. Rabbi Jachter alluded to the conflict, or the potential for conflict, if people are not clear, if people are not open, if people do not share the difficulties and their feelings, their perspectives on what's happening. Chaplaincy also deals with the trauma that accompanies serious illness to the patient, to the family, and often to the staff of hospitals and other institutions. I apologize, you can't see this too well. I had a bigger screen. It's basically a cartoon that talks about the effect of the pink elephant in the room. And Dr. Abrams referred to the when the elephant is in the room, it's hard to deal. I'm the guy who works with that elephant. The elephant is my primary client. Next slide, please. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was one of the foremost people dealing with loss. Foremost was denial. Denial means dealing with the shock and the disbelief of what has happened. Second stage is resistance. Why is this happening? A massive desire to return to life as it was. I want my life back. I want my world restored to what it was. Then they begin to move to the exploratory stage, where they examine new possibilities. And then finally they come to a state of acceptance, where there's a focus on realistic choices. Now, how do you move from stage to stage? How do you help someone who is focused or stuck, if you will, on one particular stage to get to the next phase of illness or the next stage of healing? Because the bottom line is, we can't always cure, but we can always care. We can always provide therapeutic intervention. Even if it's not curative, we can always care. Next slide, please. Again, okay. Communication and support need to be calibrated to where the people are. You can't be, you as the chaplain, you as the doctor, you as the nurse, or you as the RUV, cannot be on step 4 if the patient and the family is still on step 3 or step 2 or even on step 1. You have to measure your response appropriately to the people you're dealing with. In my shul in Binghamton, New York, 100 years ago, there was a phrase over Pusuk over the Aron Kodesh. It said, Dalef to me atomi. And I always used to have a vort. You know, when you're standing and talking to the Eberster, Dalef to me atomi. But when you turn around and talk to the Kehila, know be whom you're standing and speak appropriately so that they understand the information you're trying to get across. Same thing with support. To help people move, you need to listen to their feelings and their concerns. And then involve them in giving shape to the change that is happening. Change is ongoing. Please, next slide. Change isn't always good. Lucy says to Linus, do you think people ever really change? Linus says, sure, I feel I've changed a lot this past year. Lucy says, I meant for the better. When we're talking about serious illness, when illness strikes, change is not a good thing. You want to take a step back to health, a step to well-being. Again, Frank, don't worry, I'm not taking a step back myself. Yeah. You need to be able to move forward. Again, what I find in chaplaincy that's most helpful is listening. Listening, which is a means of validating what's happening. All the anguish, all the turmoil, all the pain of changes. It's not easy to listen to that. Often it's the last place in the world I want to be, but I know for the welfare of my client, whether that client is the patient, the family member, or the staff, the doctors and the nurses, that's where I need to be. Involvement gives them a sense of engaging them and gives them a sense of ownership. Change is thus something that they become a part of. And if someone's a part of the process, the more they participate, the more they feel a measure of control and the less resistance they'll offer. The idea being, the more control they have... too late. All right, hold on a second. Hold off on the last for a minute. The more they participate, the more control they have, and the less a sense of events are getting away from them. Change is not always easy. Change can sometimes be very painful, go very slow. But change is always possible. Things can always adapt. Now the last slide, please. Okay. Change. It does happen, even in the places you could least expect. Right? People can learn to adapt, just like animals. Right? You might want to turn around and take a look at that one. That's worth seeing. Again, spiritual, emotional, psychological support is a vital component in dealing with critical illness. Doctors don't only manage symptoms. They look to cure. They look to heal. Rabbis are often confronted with horrific choices. And yet, they're trying to cure. They're trying to heal. They're trying to help. Chaplains, I don't mean to leave out the attorneys, but chaplains also, they're focused on helping people deal with the reality of changing circumstances. From a psychological, emotional, and spiritual perspective. And please God, we're always happy to partner with the other professionals in the healthcare system.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take questions now from the audience as well as through the cards which Susan is going to collect. I would ask that if you pose a question from the audience, no filibusters, please. Just go straight to the question.
We still have ours.
We now have another microphone. Okay, we're going to, we have a request to make a few quick comments, and then we're going to open the floor for questions. By the way, the questions can be posed to the panel in general, and whichever member of the panel would like to respond to the question, please do so.
So, as a palliative physician, I think one thing we have to say is that people often come to us and say, the doctor said there's nothing we can do. And there's a slogan I know the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Care says, there's always something we can do. It may not be a cure, it may be holding the person's hand and being at the bedside and listening to them, but there's always something that you can do to help the person in their difficult time. I think one of the things that I wanted to point out, especially with the older, with the younger woman that I presented, I think if she pursues aggressive care, which you know Rabbi Jachter was saying, I think she loses things that may she may lose by devoting her last month or 2 months or whatever she has in terms of trying to help her family, in terms of quality of life. And I think that's a big price to pay for treatment that may not actually help. So I think that has that's a very important thing to evaluate, and that's a cost that is not always considered. The other comment that Dr. Dwash was pointing out was often we give oxygen. We have no issue with oxygen. Most palliative physicians, it's seen as a supportive measure. It's not something that necessarily prolongs life. It's there for comfort. And in general, my guiding principle with all my patients is, will this treatment provide comfort? Not necessarily, will this extend the person's life? And I extend that to hydration and nutrition. And I think there's a difference between someone who has a cancer with a progressive illness and someone who may have had a stroke that they can live for years with that. It's not necessarily a progressive illness in and of itself. And I think sometimes the body's actually shutting down and giving some of these things can actually be more harmful. And I guess that's where the rabbi and the doctor discussing what the risk-benefit of what you're proposing is really critical. And I think the other point that's made here was that what happens to the person lives on long beyond when that person passes away. And that's in the family and the children and the grandchildren. What did they observe? What did other friends and relatives see? And if it's a good death, and there can be a good death, it can really bring a lot of peace to a family for many, many years to come.
Now they're both not working. Hello? Okay, good. This was directed to the physicians. In light of the Golubchik case, to what extent does the family have to worry about the medical team overruling the wishes of the holder of the personal health care proxy?
I can answer that. So Manitoba has a different legislative framework than the Health Care Consent Act in Ontario. They actually don't have as robust a decision-making process and adjudication system that's set out in the Health Care Consent Act. And what they have is something by the College of Physicians Surgeons of Manitoba, which is probably not constitutional and eventually will get overturned. So it's probably not too much, it's not very useful to pay attention to what's going on in Manitoba unless you live in Manitoba. In Ontario, the only thing that can overturn a power of attorney for personal care is when the power of attorney is making decisions that is not keeping with the patient's previously expressed wishes or in keeping with the patient's best interests. And I actually have taken families to the Consent and Capacity Board for not following through on the patient's living will. So the patient and the living will had specific directions with which the family refused to accept, even though they were designated the power of attorney, and there's something called a Form G application that you can put in. And the Consent and Capacity Board, unlike other parts of the legal realm, they move quickly. So on issues of life and death issues, they will meet within 24 hours. They'll meet on New Year's Eve and Christmas Day on a Sunday. They meet in the hospital. The hearing takes about a day. By statute, they have to give a decision within 24 hours after the hearing. They have to give written reasons within 2 days after that. You have 30 days to appeal, and the appeal goes to the Ontario Superior Court. I did a systematic review of all the Consent and Capacity Board hearings in Ontario regarding withholding and withdrawing life-sustaining treatment. There's been 14 that have been published. Of the 14 cases, 11 dealt with, similar to my case, what's called a Form G application, where the physician is challenging the substitute decision maker's decision that they made. And the power of the Consent and Capacity Board is such that they can order, and this is unique to Ontario, the substitute decision maker to consent. It's called involuntary consent. Only in Ontario do we have involuntary consent. And if they refuse, the Consent and Capacity Board doesn't have the power to provide the consent, but what they can do is they can remove that person as the decision maker, and in some cases it ends up going to the public guardian trustee. The remaining cases were actually the feuding siblings. So it doesn't work in Ontario's majority rules. So if you are a widow and you have 9 children, and 8 agree with one care plan, and there's the 9th child who is an outlier and disagrees with the care plan, it's not majority rules. That one outlier can oppose the decision, and nothing can happen. So in that situation, a family member or anybody can apply to the Consent and Capacity Board to be appointed as the decision maker, and they become the decision maker. So I don't know if the lawyer has any other comments.
The lawyer.
My wife's a lawyer. So I
can. Just on that note, if the person had a power of attorney for personal care appointing all 9 children, they could embed in that a majority rule so that only, you know, so if there were 8 and 1 or 5 and 4, then the majority would be able to.
Of the 100 patients who died in the ICU when we did the chart review, there were 6 patients who had an advanced directive.
When you're talking about majority rules, there's a story of a rabbi who was sick, and the president came to visit, and they said, "Rabbi, the board of directors wants to wish you refuah shleima. We voted 4-3.
I'm not completely familiar with the whole in and out of the case in Manitoba, but I would say that as a physician, you're not obligated to do something that you feel is not medically appropriate. And I think that's that was part of the decision, that the doctors in that hospital did not feel medically that was what should be done. And that's, I think, partially part of the issue or the concern.
One of the things, getting back to that case that did happen was that there were a series of hearings. Initially, the first hearing or the first 2 hearings, I guess, were to ensure that the hospital did continue to administer life support and not withdraw life support until such a time as there could be a trial of the issues. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, Mr. Golubchuk passed away before they went to a hearing. So, you know, you're right, we don't have a decision in terms of whether this legislation or how this legislation should work in Manitoba. But again, it is very different in Ontario.
Thank you. Question, how does one stop ruminating over the what ifs and if only once the loved one has passed on? Be more of a question for our...
Is that a question for the attorney?
By a vote of 4-3, yes.
You don't want to be paying me.
I just send the bill to Rabbi Kelman. That's it. When it comes to grief, everybody grieves at their own pace. Everybody grieves at their own the cycle of grief works differently for different people. If after a considerable period of time, the individual is still wallowing in the self-recriminations, then I think the rabbi or the chaplain or the counselor would refer them to to seek professional guidance. But I mean, you have to recognize that there's a wide range of normal when it comes to grieving, and that I would really only suggest someone seek professional help after several months, maybe close to a year, of really not being able to move forward, unless their grief overtakes them and incapacitates them and paralyzes the individual. Then I might perhaps urge them.
Thank you.
Earlier.
Would you like to add to this, Rabbi Jackson?
It parses to understand and believe that Hashem's will has been issued, and to accept that, and there's a limit of what we can do.
Right.
Once we accept Hashem's judgment, then we make peace with that. This way, at Elavaya Rachman Alassan, we say Baruch Dayan Amet, the righteous judge. We make our peace with the decision, and it helps us move on.
What is the protocol if there are not enough beds in the ICU? How does this affect patients who are already there? I guess that's the politics of hospital life.
Okay. With the exception of pandemic influenza, there actually is it's not published, but there is a provincial pandemic plan that if the needs for intensive care exceed supply, and more importantly, if the people who actually work in intensive care exceed demand, that there is a triage system that is on the shelf ready to be implemented. Currently, there are something like 200 intensive care beds in the province. There's about 1,000 vent-capable beds that have mechanical ventilators with them. And as an average, the province runs at 80% capacity. So the issue that there's never a bed now, sometimes, particularly at my hospital, we run at 103% capacity, which means the patient's vented there and there's no bed. The arrest bed is the bed that you arrest in. There's no empty beds in the ICU. And so there is a mechanism in the province called Criticall where we can find those patients a bed. It doesn't always work the way it should, but often the patient sits in the emergency department for many hours until a bed is arranged. Rarely they get, for neurosurgical cases, they get shipped out to Buffalo, and when they come back, they always have MRSA. So it's not always good to go to Buffalo. So resource issues from an intensive care unit director, when you're dealing with the patient at hand, is never an issue. I had an elderly woman with end-stage lung disease dying on the ventilator for 17 months. She was a very famous Jewish educator in the city. That was her bed as long as she wanted it. And I think the vast majority of intensive care physicians would say the same. And as soon as you take a resource or rationalization issue, you're on the wrong side of the argument. And again, I think the vast majority of intensive care physicians and clinical directors and administrators will take that. On a policy decision, listen, they're cutting beds. The government's got a $24 billion deficit. They're closing hospitals. They're cutting beds, trust me. But from an individual patient issue, it's never a situation, except in maybe war. I'm sure there's a halakhic decision for that.
The wife owns a property and becomes incapacitated. Does the husband automatically get control over it?
That would be for me. That question.
That's good.
No, not necessarily. Again, you'd want to ensure that there was a power of attorney that the person that would appoint the husband, if that was the wish of the person, that the husband would be able to step in and deal with that property. But it's not. Without a power of attorney, you can't. The husband would not necessarily be able to go and sell that property. It may need to become a guardian of the of the property for the incapable person. So, not clear cut. Where if they were to own the property jointly, and the husband wanted to sell the property, they would in that case as well. In Ontario, you would need to the spouse has to sign off on the sale of the property, so you'd need a power of attorney in that case as well. So not an easy situation necessarily.
Well, thank you.
There's a question here. The first part is, are the capacity assessors in use for the assessment for the attorney, presumably the personal attorney for personal care, where it appears that the individual is not capable or not receiving adequate care? The answer to that, I believe, is no, and it would be a Form G application. If the person's not making good decisions on behalf of the incapable patient, then the care provider, the physician or practitioner, can challenge that person's decision through the consent capacity board. The question below. Oh.
That was no. The question. You want to clarify the question then? A little louder.
I'm sorry. Okay.
So, in my case, my mother suffered from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and a heart failure. And I figured out too late that she would have benefited from having supplementary oxygen tank on basically on a full-time basis, so at least to have.
Okay, I think I got the question. Basically, without going into detail about standard of care and whether the appropriate treatment decisions were made, a substitute decision maker or a patient can only consent to a treatment after it's been proposed. So, for example, if a parent brings their kid into the doctor's office with an earache and says, oh, I want you to prescribe antibiotics, and the physician says, well, actually it looks viral. No. And the family, the mother says, I insist. The physician can still say no because the physician hasn't proposed to prescribe antibiotics. If the physician proposes, I think we should put her on the child on antibiotics, then it's up to the parent to consent to that treatment plan. But in the absence of a plan, or a specific treatment that's being proposed, there's nothing to consent to. So if there was a lapse in care, I'm sorry to hear about the circumstances, but it doesn't sound like it's a consent issue. It sounds like more a treatment decision issue. Yeah.
I have one question that I'd like to pose to every member of the panel before we conclude, and we invite you to continue this discussion because in terms of time, it doesn't really allow us to ask all the wonderful questions that we've received, and we've had some excellent questions. Each member of the panel, could you please summarize the steps that one should take before serious illness strikes from a legal, medical, and halachic perspective? And we'll start with Dr. Abrams.
I usually get involved after it's coming,
something's happened. I guess understanding the issues and having a sense of what could happen or what you would want and talking to your relatives, knowing what some of the options are. But I think it is very difficult in the abstract to know what you would want when you get to that point. And that's the difficult challenge. And knowing that palliative care is supportive care and that people actually, I believe, live longer with it and it's not necessarily giving up.
Dr. Dvash.
When I speak to families, most patients in the ICU are not capable, particularly when it's dealing with end-of-life care decisions. And when I speak to families, often I'll tell them, I don't need to speak to families to know what families want. 99 times of 100, a loving family, they're going to want you to do everything possible. They want their loved one to get better. And they also don't, if the patient can't get better, they don't want to see their loved one suffer.
Rabbi Jackta.
I'm not finished. Okay. So I don't need to speak to families to know what they want. I need to speak to families to know what the patient would want. And so the two questions that I ask for of family members is, number one, if your loved one was of sound mind and sitting here listening to us have this important conversation, number one, what questions would he have of me as the doctor? Because those are the kinds of questions that you should be asking. And number two, what sort of responses could I expect from that person? No, I'm done. Sorry.
See how the doctor could be overbearing? Not in this case.
Nice, you get to learn how to.
Never jack this.
So on the RCA healthcare proxy, make sure that it's legally executed properly with your attorney. Talk with your rabbi and talk with your family. Make a simple statement about what your view is about end-of-life care. And at all times, think about this issue and really all others with families, how to maximize shalom bayit, how to maximize family harmony.
So I'm going to be quick. Just see your lawyer. No. Seriously.
Mrs. Blumenfeld.
obviously, that you have put some thought into who should be your substitute decision maker and what sort of instructions, what sort of decisions do you want them to make on your behalf? Because, as Dr. Josh has just said, it's the decision that you want that your attorney is supposed to be making, not necessarily the decision that they would make themselves.
Rabbi Weiss.
I'm also always called in after the fact, but I would pick up on something, on the very last thing that Rabbi Jacker said. Shalom bayit is perhaps the key to everything that we've discussed tonight. Rarely does a dysfunctional family start to function much better when they find themselves in the midst of crisis and trauma. That doesn't happen. People deal with illness often the same way they deal with health. And if things can be maintained on an even keel through shalom bayit and people working together for what is ostensibly the best outcome for the entire family, not just in the best interests of the patient who comes first, but what's in the best interest of the entire family, that will ultimately be the best resolution.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Orthodox Union I represent, Frank Buchweitz, is proud to have brought this program to you tonight with Congregation B'nai Torah and with Torah in Motion. I'd like to call upon everyone, that the person that you all know, our dear Rabbi Kelman.
I want to thank all the speakers, the OU, B'nai Torah, Mr. Emerson, Stanley Emerson, for his warm introduction. You can hear I have a slight cold. I hope it's not a serious illness. But, I'm sure everybody in the room knows, our family went through this just in the summer, really all of a sudden. Serious illness, struck in our family really very unexpectedly. And it was, I guess, extremely quick from, 2.5 weeks from the beginning. And, thank God, I in terms of shalom bayit and peace, I think we had that within the family, and we think we did the right things as much as we can. It's up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it is very important to prepare, to hope, as we said before, we don't need it, but and if this evening can bring some, people to think about it a little more and to prepare a little bit more, it'll be extremely worthwhile. And I thank you all for coming. I thank all our speakers. And I have not, I'm not Davin Marid yet, because I was picking up our speakers at the airport. So if we can make a minion in a couple minutes, greatly appreciated on a personal level for all of us. I assume downstairs we can Davin in the shul in a few minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, before we go, I'd like to hear a beautiful round of applause for a wonderful evening from Dr. Abrams, Dr. Dvash, Rabbi Jachter, Mrs. Blumenfeld, and Rabbi Weiss. And give yourself an applause for coming here tonight. Have a wonderful Hanukkah, everyone.